Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to thank and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi everyone, and welcome to Room by Room, the Home Organization Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with expert knowledge from professionals in the field. I'm your host, Gabriella Yastra, coming to you from NAM, Melbourne, Australia. Let's get started. Hi everyone and welcome back to the show. Today we're going to be talking about the relationship between air tightness and thermal control, exploring the benefits and challenges with Andy Marlow, who is an architect, a director at Envirotecture and Passive House Design and Construct. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to be here.
Yes, thank you. I'm looking forward to learning more about air tightness and thermal control. I think it's very important at the moment. For anyone listening to this at a later date or somewhere else, it's currently very cold in Melbourne or Australia, it's winter. So I think this is very relevant to me at least. But before we do talk about that, we're going to get to know you a little bit better. Do you mind introducing yourself so we can learn more about you?
Sure. So my name's Andy. I'm an architect by training. I'm also a certified passive house designer and I'm a director of those firms that were mentioned. And we are a collective of around 12 people at the moment who have a couple of offices, one in Sydney, one in Ballarat. And we do mostly residential work across Australia in basically all places. And we're involved in any project where people want to do good. As to what do good is, that's a longer discussion. I'm sure we'll touch on bits of it. But fundamentally, we care about people. We also care about buildings, and if you're going to have buildings, then the buildings should be good for the people that are inside them. And as you say, today's the shortest day of the year in our hemisphere, and therefore not necessarily the coldest day, but the day with the least sun at least, and therefore making sure buildings work is incredibly important. So we're going to talk about that a fair bit, I reckon.
Yes, I think so. But before we do, we're going to do a section called Have You Met Andy, where we get to know you through some of your favorite things. And the first thing we'd like to know is, are you listening to any podcasts at the moment?
I am. A few. But my favorite one at the moment is probably, it's a work-related one. It's out of the UK and it's called Zero Ambitions, which is a lovely play on words. And it's a couple of guys who actually marketing people and they publish a magazine about passive house buildings. They're incredibly relaxed, I would say. I wouldn't say they're unprofessional, but they're very just getting it done, not highbrow production values. They ramble a lot, but they have really good conversations and they get stuck in a way that they challenge basically every norm that exists. And I really enjoy that because a lot of stuff people don't really ask the tough questions. So I've been getting probably more value out of that than any of the others lately. So they take a while. They're supposed to be 45 minutes. They always go for an hour and a half. So
I suppose when you've got lots to talk about, that's what happens. And that's what happens sometimes here as well.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing. And if you want to turn off, you do, and you come back to it later and it's totally fine. So It works for me. I find a lot of the other things to be very repetitive and dull. So these guys they're not that. So, yeah, it works.
Great. Thanks for the recommendation. And do you have a role model?
I'm not entirely sure. I think I've got a few. I've got people who've inspired me at various points along the way. And I feel that there's a few in my life, like one of my business partners, my original partner in Envirotecture, who's the guy, Dick Clark, who started the firm. Like, he's been a role model for years. He's done some really great things and he has an attitude to life and a way of going through life that's, fairly fantastic at just getting on with things regardless of the obstacles that are put in your way. So he'd rate up pretty highly. And then I've got some in my personal life, just, people who are generally awesomely inspiring. And a couple along those lines.
That's great.
But yes, nobody particularly famous or notable. They're all sort of the ones that I know well who've influenced me on a very human level.
I think, I mean, there seems to be, after talking to people for quite a few episodes now, two types of role models. There's the famous role models that you look up to, and then there's the people in your life who've actually directly influenced you, you know, by their existence or through, I guess, you know, actually talking to you and working with you. So I think both are relevant and both are good.
I think the idea of having a role model doesn't make a great deal of sense in that in that way. But, you know, there are these different people for different things. And some people are really great. What can be really conflicting is the people who are awesome role models for a particular reason, and yet other parts of their life can be a complete car crash. But you still get what you get from them. It doesn't mean it's bad. It just really just means that humans are humans and no one's perfect.
I think we found any perfect people, then they'd have to be everyone's role model, but no one like that exists. So,
indeed. And if they say they do, you should be really, really worried.
I think so. And have you completed any courses that have inspired you?
I've completed a few. The one that's probably been most influential, though, is the one that's ultimately led us to be having the conversation we're having today, which was around 6 years ago. I became a certified passive house designer, and this course back then, at least, was a 10-day full-time course followed by a 3-hour lock yourself in a room exam. It's the hardest thing professionally that I've ever done. Still, I thought something might trump it, but it hasn't. And really, it's a deep dive introduction into, well, passive house, which is all building physics, building performance. And everything to do with why buildings work the way that they do at a physics level rather than an architecture level. So it was incredibly intense. But yeah, it was incredibly influential as to what's happened next. So I'm grateful I did it. And I'm glad I don't have to do it again.
I do think that it's great to have something that was so hard in your past, because then you can say, oh, this thing I've just done, it's nothing, it's fine.
Exactly. Everything else from that point on is just downhill in a positive, in a good way, not a bad way.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And I'm glad you defined what passive house is, because I was wondering that. So thank you.
That's quite all right. I'm sure it'll come up more than once.
Great. Great. And so, speaking of definitions, how do you define home organization?
Well, for me, home organization is possibly different to others. I guess I look at it from a sort of from a professional perspective rather than on the personal level. I look at it on personal level too, but that's not today, I suppose. And really, we as a species live in buildings because at some point we decided it was better than not living in buildings. And obviously these things have evolved over millennia. And it's around about the idea that home is this place, this thing that nurtures people. If they don't nurture you, then arguably you're better off without them, in which case you're living not in a building, and that, generally speaking, isn't particularly desirable. If you live on the tropics on a nice island, maybe, but most places in the world you want to be inside, at least for some of the time, and therefore it's about this place nurturing, keeping you healthier than you would be otherwise, keeping you warmer in winter like today or cooler in summer, and really it ends up being about health. There's a reason we chose to not live in trees, in caves, and outdoors. And therefore, the places we choose to dwell really should make that happen. That's unfortunately not the case for a huge number of people, but that's part of the work that we do, is to try to the best that we can, change that so that people are better off inside the buildings than they would be otherwise.
Yeah, I know that... sometimes our buildings can be harbors for not so safe things like mold, which could mean that it's not as safe to be inside as outside. But for the most part, you know, it keeps us warm, keeps us dry, keeps us mostly away from critters that we don't necessarily want to have in our house, like snakes, and keeps us safe, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if your home isn't doing those things for you, it's not a great place to start from psychologically. And And that ends up flowing through. It's why the current conversation around sort of housing affordability is so important. It's sure, it's about money to some degree, but it's about people's ability to be the best self that they can. And if you don't have a home that works for you or don't have a home at all, then you're immediately behind the eight ball and you're going to struggle to, you know, do life in any meaningful way. And you're going to find it much harder than other people who aren't in that position. So housing is basically the key to absolutely everything in society. And it appears that over the past few decades, as the developed world, really, we've forgotten that and it's become a commodity. And now we're sort of starting to see the edges fraying, to put it mildly, as we grapple with the fact that we've made some fairly silly decisions over time.
Yes. And what are some misconceptions about home organisation?
Well, the fact that it's a commodity and it's not about humans, really. It's probably, it doesn't fit nicely with the way the questions sort of came across, I guess. But it really, disorganisation is never good for anything, really. If the places people are living in aren't looking after them in that sense, in that sort of, mainly from a health perspective, then everything goes pear-shaped from there. And the hospital system pays a price, and the school system pays a price, and the welfare system pays a price, all because we haven't successfully managed to house people in buildings that are appropriate. So it's a pretty big picture.
Okay. So today we're going to be talking about airtightness and thermal control. So we're going to do a few definitions first. So what is ventilation?
Ventilation can, in the real world, be many different things in terms of how it's delivered, but fundamentally it's the provision of air. Now, that can be what we refer to as fresh air, which normally actually means outdoor air. And as bushfires in Canada last week and Australia a couple of years ago show, outdoor air is not necessarily always fresh, but we use these terms interchangeably. And in our world of sort of architecture and building science in particular, a lot of words that get used colloquially have meaning that may or may not actually really be their meaning. So it's always a little bit interesting, the words that people throw around. You're like, yeah, it's not quite what that means. So ventilation is really about that provision of air. And we often distinguish between mechanical ventilation, which is provided by some sort of mechanical device, which is normally a fan, or natural ventilation, which is generally in our world considered opening a window.
Yep. And I'm guessing airtightness is the opposite of ventilation. So it's the sealing of something so that there's no airflow.
Yes, basically it is. It's the idea predicated on control. So the idea is that you have total control over what happens inside your building because it is airtight when everything is closed up. Now, assuming your building still has windows, which nearly every building does, and should, then there's a sensible need, although it isn't the case in most Australian buildings, that when everything is closed, it is actually airtight. Most Australian buildings are not airtight. There's a lovely study from the CSIRO that shows how not airtight they really are. And therefore, if they're not airtight, you can't have control because I'm unsure what your house is like, but if you're in Melbourne, it's cold right now. And if it gets windy and cold, then you start to feel drafts coming in. And that's because there's holes somewhere inside the envelope, the external perimeter of your building. And that's incredibly common, so don't feel special. But that's not airtightness. Like, that's the opposite of. And it's how these two things and a few other factors of passive house all come together that's incredibly important. So passive house actually has five sort of aspects to it, one of which is the airtightness, one of which is the ventilation. It also has insulation, which most people understand fairly simply. It also has mitigating thermal bridges, which is basically construction detailing related. So if you have a large steel beam that goes from outside to inside, then when it's cold outside, the beam will get cold. And because steel is very good at conducting heat and cold, it will also be cold inside. And that's bad for thermal comfort, but mostly it's bad for condensation because cold things in warm-ish buildings get condensation on them. So, and then the final part of the sort of the five key principles of passive house are around windows and doors, and just having appropriate windows and doors that are appropriately placed and appropriately shaded. So obviously in different parts of the world, that means very different things, but it means that they need to be considered. So that's sort of the bigger picture of all of those.
Interesting. And so why is it important to think of these things?
It really comes back to the original premise of why do we bother with buildings at all? Obviously, mm-hmm. on a whole bunch of levels, so from an environmental point of view, we'd be better off if no one lived in buildings. They consume 40% of the world's resources. So, you know, that's a lot. And the world would be a very different place. That's not necessarily what I'm advocating. It's not what I'm advocating for, obviously. So why do these things all really matter and come together? Because if we're going to be inside and we want to be healthy, then we need to be able to control our indoor environment so that we don't have mold or condensation, so that we're not too hot or too cold. And fundamentally, in almost every place in the world, you can't achieve that without the use of some form of energy. So whether it's heating or cooling or a bit of both, depending on where you are, different amounts, obviously. And therefore, if you're going to add energy to create heat or cool to maintain comfort, then you want to have control over the space. Otherwise, you're literally just throwing energy into a, well, into a string bag or whatever analogy you wish to use. But why would you try and heat a house that has a whole bunch of holes in it? We do all the time. The entire nation is currently doing that today because it's fairly cold. Doesn't make any sense. And therefore, this idea around airtightness is really around control. And then the ventilation component that goes with it is around the fact that, and today's actually the fantastic example. So it's cold outside almost everywhere in the country, maybe not in Cairns, I'm not sure. And therefore, if it's cold outside and you've heated your house to be 20 degrees, so it's quite nice inside, you still need outdoor air, fresh air, or whatever you want to term it. And therefore, how do you get that? If you open a window, which you can, then the air outside is going to come inside to some degree, and you're going to get cold again, and then you have to heat the house up again. When we start using mechanical ventilation with heat recovery, which is what all the passive house projects have, then that fan is going to bring in that fresh, or that outdoor air. It's got filters on the mechanical unit so that it's fresh, it's filtered outdoor air, which generally means it's pretty fresh. And therefore, you get that energy, but it's coming in at a much warmer temperature. And therefore, you don't get the penalty, the energy penalty that you get when you open your window. Mm. So it works as a holistic system.
But I'm guessing that that mechanism that brings the air in, that will use some energy.
Mm, about the same as an old halogen light globe. So okay. The unit itself is for an average house, an average Australian house anyway, which is the biggest in the world, the unit is about the size of a bar fridge. It's probably the best way to describe it. And it's got a few bits to it. So it's got two fans, it's got two filters, and then it's got two fairly chunky ducts that lead to the outside world. They're about 165 millimeters each. One of those is always bringing air into that unit. And the other is always taking air out. On the other side of that unit, so inside the unit, fresh the new air is coming in, and then old air is going out of the building. And those two air streams are passing each other, and the heat's moving from the outgoing air to the incoming air, but they're not mixing. So the air itself, it's not the same air. You're just getting the heat to transfer.
Okay, on the other, that's smart.
Yeah, it's literally, it's two fans and some filters. Considering it's fairly dumb technology in a lot of ways. It's not, of course, but it kind of is. On the other side, what's happening is you've got a whole series of ducts that are much smaller, and they run to every room in the house so that all of the living rooms or places where people spend time, so living rooms, bedrooms, study, all those spaces, they're constantly being supplied with that air. So it's fairly warm. It's fresh or it's outdoor filtered air, And that's coming into those places the whole time. And then exactly the same time, because this just runs all 24/7, the places that are wet spaces, so bathrooms, laundries, kitchens, they're having air extracted from those spaces. And the amount of air put into the building is the same as the air taken out of the building. So we call that balanced ventilation. And therefore, you've got this continual turnover of air inside your building that's bringing in the fresh filtered stuff from outside and getting rid of the moist air. And this is how you basically, you can open your windows, totally up to you. I mean, on a day like, well, actually in Sydney this afternoon, it's quite nice. So you might open the window anyway, even though it's a little bit cool. But you know, in a few hours time when it's, whatever it's going to be, 8 degrees outside, you don't want to open the window because it's silly. And therefore you don't have to, because you get the filtered outdoor air. You've got the temperature happening with the air doing the heat recovery. And therefore, you're comfortable inside. You're not really using much energy. And it's all very nice and comfy.
Because I don't have this equipment in my house. I live in a rented place. It's built in the 70s, 80s. So it's not the best building. And I find in summer it's fine. I can leave the windows and doors open, get some lovely fresh air in when there's no bushfires or pollen in the air. But in winter, I find it gets quite stale because I don't want to open the windows and doors. It's too cold for that. Although I get plenty of fresh air through all the cracks in the walls.
We refer to that as infiltration. So it's not actually fresh air. If you imagine, so you said the 70s, let's whatever, like what's that, 40, 50 years ago? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, possibly not, but I've witnessed various buildings being taken apart. And when you find a wall that's been there for 50 or 60 years and you see it come apart, it is not clean on the inside.
Oh.
And therefore, all of the air, because of this. So the air that was outside has come to inside your house, and it's come through gaps and cracks, basically. And therefore, air's been coming through those gaps and cracks for 50 years, which included pollution, lead paint, lead from petrol when we still had lead in petrol, all the stuff that you get. And therefore, all the air that comes in your house is going past all of these pollutants at the same time. So it is a common misconception, to be fair, that, you know, that is fresh air. It's like, no, it's air from outside that's been dragged over some dirty stuff.
Oh, okay. That's, so, I mean, you were saying that, I can't remember the name of the passive house system that you were saying, but it has a filter in there. So that will actually not just capture anything that's in the walls. I mean, it won't have to worry about that, but it also stops anything from outside from coming in that we don't want to come in. So it's actually fresher than fresh air.
Yes, indeed. So yes, it's the correct terminology is a mechanical ventilation with heat recovery, which gets mm-hmm. shortened to MVHR, which is, mm-hmm. it's not that snappy. Bear in mind, passive house as a concept was originated from some building physicists. And while they're incredibly smart, they're not particularly marketing savvy. And it was 30 odd years ago. So you got to give them a little bit of credit. But yes, some of the terminology is not very user-friendly. But yes, that box has the filters, and therefore as the air goes through, it does get filtered. So when the bushfires, when we had the bushfires here, 2019, 2020, quite a lot of really interesting thing, I mean, terrible as they were interesting things that happened in the midst of that with a few people in the passive house world who had these units inside their houses. So the first one was that the standard filters are not enough to filter bushfire smoke. So the particulates in bushfire smoke are really small. So they'll go down to about 0.3 of a micron, whereas the standard filters are pulling out anything that's bigger than 2.5. So these bushfire smoke filters can, bushfire particulates can be really, really tiny. But what they did was a couple of them pretty much just butchered their own units, which is brave, but they're smart guys, and they put in HEPA grade filters. And then because they have monitoring inside the house, they could monitor what was happening inside their house. Other people nearby who have different systems monitored theirs, and you could see the difference. And fundamentally, it was chalk and cheese. And there's a lovely anecdotal story. There's a lady in Canberra who owns a couple of three childcare centres, but one of them she built to the passive house standard. And there's this wonderful photo of her and her daughter during the bushfires. So, like, you know, red stuff out the window, and they're sleeping. They're living in the childcare centre because the air quality was significantly better than anywhere in Canberra, including their own house. And yeah, they just lived there for a couple of weeks.
I mean, if you could, why wouldn't you? You know, exactly. The air quality is so much better.
Indeed. But the bigger question is, why are we building buildings that don't adapt to these issues? Like, this is, yes, that was unprecedented, but that was unprecedented 2 years ago. Then it just happened in Canada, and it's happened in North America before, and it's probably going to happen here again this summer. The definition of unprecedented doesn't apply if it keeps happening. That's called a pattern. So We haven't really cottoned on yet as a nation.
So would you say that we should start fitting these MVHRs with the HEPA filters into every home?
We don't suggest that the HEPA filter is in there every day. So it turns out the unit itself is quite well, incredibly well engineered. In order, you made the comment about the energy it uses. So in order to operate as efficiently as possible, they've sized the fans to be able to push the air through that particular grade of filter. And therefore, when you put the HEPA grade filter in, the fan has to work harder than usual because it's trying to push stuff through smaller holes, which is obviously what a filter is. And therefore, if you ran it with HEPA grade stuff all the time, you'd basically, the unit would die sooner and use more energy on the way through. So you could redesign the units, but we don't need that level of filtration most of the time. So what we've been doing ever since the bushfires is we have a little extra box on top of the unit. And you literally, when the bushfires come or anything bad externally, smoke, like particulate matter wise is happening, you just basically undo a flap, put in the HEPA grade filter, wait for whatever it is to pass, take it out again, and you use it as you need it.
Okay, well, that definitely makes sense. But what about, so, I mean, I imagine it'd be easy to install the MVHR into new buildings, but what about older buildings that already exist? Is that possible?
Anything's possible.
Is it easy?
Oh, that's a completely different question. Look, it depends. Sometimes it can be fairly straightforward. Sometimes it will be as close to impossible as you can get. So it really is a building by building case. The deciding factor is the other things that are going on. So if a building is being retrofitted properly, then normally you can find a way to do it because there's enough other change happening that you can get to places, because you've basically got to find somewhere to put this box, you've got to connect it to the outside world twice, and then you've got to run all this ductwork around the building. If you're gutting a building, then you can see and get to almost everything, and therefore it's sort of doable. If all you're doing is replacing a toilet, then obviously you're not pulling everything else apart. So it's a little bit, you know, it does vary, but it doesn't mean that you don't have a crack. And it's certainly good to have, I guess, a strategy for how you're going to do these things when the time comes. So there's also a series of what are known as decentralized fans. So instead of having that central box that we described, is literally just, there could be either one or two fans that have got a heat recovery component to them. So it's basically a heavy ceramic honeycomb core in the middle, and they pull and push air through them. Sometimes there's two of them, and therefore they sort of pull and push on a connection so that they're working in the same or in the opposite way at the same time so that it's balanced. And those ones are really useful for retrofits when you don't have access or the space, or when the constraints are too great. And you can put them at in the front of a terrace house and the back of a terrace house. So, you know, in the inner west of Sydney and inner Melbourne would be the same. And they're not perfect, but they'll still bring in enough air for the equivalent of sort of two people to be, you know, properly catered for. And even if you have four people in the building, it's still better than opening a window.
Okay. But does that system retain that thermal comfort that we were talking about before?
Yes, but not as well. So they're just,
okay.
The nature of them, they're just not as efficient. They're still pretty good. So they're still worth doing. If it's all you can do, it's still worth doing. At the end of the day, the rough rule of thumb is that if it's 0 degrees inside and 20 degrees outside, when that zero air is coming in, instead of coming in at zero, which is what you get when you open the window, because of the heat exchange, you'll probably, depending on the unit, end up with incoming air being somewhere between 16 and 18 degrees, which is significantly higher than zero.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's the key. Yeah. That's the key thing. It's, you know, nothing's perfect. It's fairly close to perfect. But really, it's, well, what's your alternative? And it is open windows, and that's not fun.
Yes. So now if we can't install any of these things into our homes, but we're still trying to improve the, you know, thermal retention and the airtightness of the building, what can we do to improve that?
Airtightness is... There are certain things that are fairly easy to do. They'll get you a certain way. But the simple things around draft sealing buildings is fairly effective. They'll get rid of the worst bits of leakiness fairly easily. Normally it's doors and windows that they just don't seal particularly well. And depending on whether they're timber or aluminium or whatever they're made from and how old they are and whether they're actually straight. A lot of old timber things end up being not particularly straight. So there's a bunch of seals that you can apply to those that are fairly cost effective. Most of them are doable for someone who's, you know, vaguely competent. So, you know, we have a very big DIY culture, and in some ways it's a really big problem because there's a lot of people doing things that they really shouldn't be doing. We spend a lot of our jobs taking apart things that were done by people who thought they knew what they were doing.
I should tell my dad that because I feel like he's one of them.
There's a lot of, yes, it's very rarely a woman.
The other thing is, the other day I actually had someone from the government come to door knocking around my building, actually offering to put in seals into the doors. To make them more airtight, which I thought was really great. And I was looking at it afterwards. It's basically like just a thick, sticky thing that sits between the door and the door jamb to prevent air. And I was like, oh, I could have done that.
Yes, you could.
Doesn't seem too hard.
It's not really. So. But again, why would most people know about this? It's not something that anyone's taught. Should you be taught? I mean, no one's taught how to fix cars, and most people haven't fixed a car in a couple of decades. You know, you assume your car is going to work. Most people, somewhat foolishly, it turns out, assume that their house will work. So, yeah.
Like me, thinking my house is working when it's...
Oh, the number of people who are buying houses at the moment which are, you know, sold as being legally compliant, which they may or may not be, who think that their house will work because it's compliant. It's like, no, it just means it's not illegal. It doesn't mean it's a good house.
In that case, before you buy a house, should you get someone to have a look at it?
Yes, definitely. For a myriad of reasons, not only to do with health and comfort, but just general, regardless of how old the house is, in fact, just because unless you're a builder or a structural engineer, you just don't really know everything to look for, and they're really expensive. Like, people spend more money more time researching a new phone than some people do buying houses. And, you know, people ring up and go, oh, you know, we bought this house. It's like, oh yeah. And you look online, it's like, oh, you know, $1 million+. It's like, and now we found out this, this, and this. It's like, but didn't you think to check before you spent $1 million? Turns out not for everybody.
Yeah. And then you have to spend another $1 million to make it habitable or make it better.
Or we thought we could fix it for $50,000 because that's what it said online. It's like, did you ring anybody who actually renovates buildings? So anyway, yeah. So, but again, people aren't taught these things. It's no one's fault. It's, you know, it's an expectation that society has set that people have, and it just turns out that it's not being delivered on very well.
So maybe it's changing, I guess, how we're changing the legalities, maybe. If something's legal but it's not actually particularly good, maybe we should change what's legal to have.
Oh, indeed. The easiest way to fix all of these problems is to change the law and have a benchmark for compliance that is where it needs to be, which is currently is woefully inadequate. And your wonderful state of Victoria this week just announced that they're going to delay the changes to the building code for energy related issues for an extra 6 months, 8 months. So you were supposed to have new regulations starting in October, and for reasons that I think are fairly sketchy, they've decided to delay it until May next year.
Oh, great.
It's another reason everyone should move to New South Wales, because it's slightly better than Victoria.
Slightly better. Okay.
Slightly better. Not much, to be fair, but yeah.
Okay. Is there something that you wanted to talk about here that we've missed?
I think we probably touched on most things. I guess really to emphasize the fact that buildings, when done well, are this wonderful kind of platform from which people can thrive, whether it's you, your kids, your family, whatever, it doesn't matter, whether it's a community building. Buildings done well are incredibly uplifting to people in society en masse, and it makes them incredibly important. As a whole, society has devalued them and made them a commodity, and you know, they are really expensive, so there's a reason for that. But we've sort of lost sight of why we have buildings at all. And I think coming back to that, and then, yes, I end up in a whole bunch of deep technical things about how they work. Most people don't need to know that. They just need to know what to ask for and to have knowledge that what it is that they've asked for is being delivered. And at that point, you can, to some degree, get on with everything else. Life is busy, and people don't want to be worried about, is my house hot, cold? Do I need to put seals around my door? Because why weren't they there to start with? Those kind of things. In order to be a platform, it needs to be stable, and then it needs to effectively be able to be ignored, apart from maintenance. You still maintain your house. But, you know, therefore, you can do all these wonderful things that you want to do with your time and not have to worry about what is basically survival in an inappropriate climate.
It's a bit like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where having a livable place for shelter is at the bottom. And once that's fulfilled, then you can start pursuing, I guess, the higher things, knowledge, those types of thing.
Yeah. The number of energy prices are about to go up, depending on where you are and whether it's gas or electricity, stratospherically on 1st of July. If we have a particularly cold winter, there'll be a huge number of people who spend winter literally in survival mode, choosing between food and heat, which is not, historically hasn't been a massive issue in Australia. Energy is still really cheap compared to the rest of the world. It's much more expensive than it used to be here, and therefore that's why it's hurting people. But it's much more of in particular the UK, where the concept of fuel poverty has been a thing for years, whereas here it's hardly talked about, but I feel it's a phrase we're going to see a lot more of in the media in the next couple of months.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw it was last year when we had the energy increases and quite a cold winter, and I don't think it's gotten much better this year. We just aren't talking about it as much.
Yet.
At the moment. Yes, yes.
Wait till around about the 3rd of July.
Okay.
So, because the prices will go up and then the media will catch on and people start talking and yeah. Anyway, right. I mean, solving these problems through better buildings is a very long-term thing. But if we don't, I mean, the Victorian government's decision about energy is actually a great example. There'll be, I think Victoria builds about 180,000 houses in a year. So let's say that 100,000 homes get built between now and next May. That's 100,000 buildings that are still woefully inappropriate, and therefore that's another 100,000 families or individuals, whoever lives in them, living in effectively substandard homes because we delayed a decision today to kick something down the line. So changing that decision wouldn't fix all the other people, wouldn't change your house, but it wouldn't add to the problem. We're still adding to the problem at the same time, some people are trying to solve the old problems, but you're just adding and adding and adding. It's very short-sighted.
Unfortunately, other than talking about it and I guess going to our government and asking for these things, there isn't much that we can do about legislature and the law. But what is something that you do in your own home to balance ventilation and thermal comfort that you can do practically now?
Look, for most people, it would be a version of what happened at your place. It would be draft sealing whatever needs to be draft sealed. Obviously, if you rent, that's a whole different level of pain. You'd still get away with that. If you own the place, you can insulation's fairly cheap, and depending on the building, you can do that stuff safely yourself. It has a huge bang for its buck, especially if you've currently got no insulation. So that can be really helpful. And fundamentally, what people are trying to do, what we're trying to do at the building, to, you know, a very high level of sort of performance and to sort of high level of specification and detail, is those things are the same things that you're trying to get people to do when they've got very little money, very little time, and very little skill. You're still trying to solve the same problem of make the building as airtight as I can, insulate it as best as I possibly can. The ventilation's hard, because if you don't have the fans, then you really do just have to open windows. And that is tough, but it's better than not. There's a hard, harsh balance between being too cold or staying warmer, but then ending up with the mold problem. So you do need to ventilate your buildings, and whether that's through fans, even just a bathroom fan, as long as it's actually going to the outside world, or opening windows.
And I guess it's also about picking when and where you ventilate versus thermal control. I don't know if this is relevant for other people, but generally during the day when it's a bit warmer, I open the windows for ventilation. At night, I seal everything up, maybe heat one room that I'm in, and then I find that works for me, sort of balancing that, getting ventilation during the day and then thermal comfort at night.
Yeah, that's a really sensible and really common reaction when the building won't let you do more than that cost effectively. So ideally all the rooms would be warm all the time, but that exactly it. Yes, of course, but it doesn't always work, or it can't work, or it's stupidly expensive to do so. So those strategies are really good. One of the really important things is having ways to get moisture out of the building. So you breathe, which is good, because not breathing's bad. But also, you know, showers, laundry, cooking, all put quite a lot of moisture into the air. And you really want to make sure that that gets out of the building as quickly as possible, because it's that increased moisture that will lead to the condensation and mold. So whether it's an exhaust, like your range hood, so the number of people who don't use range hoods because they don't like the noise is very, very, very high, it turns out. Exactly. So firstly, it's a design problem, right? Why do we design range hoods that nobody wants to use? But we did. So firstly, they need to get their act together, and there are some that are better, of course. But yes, you need to get that moisture out of the building as quickly as possible. And sometimes that involves opening a window. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else that we haven't touched on?
I don't think so.
Okay, great. So we'll move on to the open mic section. So that's where you get to talk about something that isn't necessarily related to the topic, but it is something that you're passionate about. Did you have a thought about what you wanted to talk about?
I think we've probably covered it, because I'm on a bit of a... Oh, actually, no, I do have one. It's related.
Okay.
I had a very intense work 6 months, and therefore my head's very much in all these things. And apart from spending time with my kid, nothing else has significantly happened. So Envirotech has existed for 25 years, and we've always done what we used to call sustainable buildings. What sustainable mean? Who knows? The meaning's changed over the years. It's become sort of meaningless in some ways. Like, you can throw a stick at it. You can drive a truck through some of the holes. Anyway, the point was the words were always important. we went on after a while, especially with the passive house projects, to start talking about them being high performance homes because they perform much better than all the other homes, which don't perform well. And it's only in the last 6 weeks or 8 weeks or so that myself and business partners and just people we know who do similar things, like we've been having these conversations. It's like, this is wrong because high performance implies a degree of elitism and that it's, you know, high performance. I don't know about you. As soon as I think of high performance, I start thinking about Formula One or, you know, race cars or, you know, things that are bigger and bigger, better, faster, all of those sort of types of things. And they're all, you know, I'd argue to some degree unnecessary or decadent or high end, or they have all these other connotations that go with them. And what we've realized is that this isn't the case. The buildings that we've been building aren't high performance. They're what we're trying to get the world to change words or the meaning. So we're talking about them in terms of being appropriate performance. So it's about, you know, is it warm inside your house today while it's whatever it is, 4 degrees outside? Is it cool inside when it's 44 degrees? Is the air okay outside as there's a bushfire 4 kilometers down the road? Like, we're saying that it's appropriate that that's how your building performs. Now, the inverse of this, of course, is that most people's buildings are actually inappropriate, and that's not particularly, it's not a very friendly thing to say. But it happens to also be true, and we've realized that the words are really important, and therefore we need to start talking in about a way that's much more honest, and therefore we are now referring to appropriate performance and inappropriate performance. And whether we have any success with this, who knows? We're architects. We're not media people.
Okay. That's interesting, though. I guess it's like comparing where the bar is, and currently the bar is on the floor. And the bar, so it looks like your bar is very high, but it's not actually that high. It's just a reasonable height. Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Our bar, so Belgium, and as of quite recently, Scotland. So the bar, so when we do our, like when we do certified passive house projects, the nation of Belgium and the nation of Scotland, their bar is now at that level for every house, every new house.
Okay.
Because we haven't talked about energy really at all. The whole point of the control part is that you want to be able to keep your health and your comfort without using a huge amount of energy. And therefore, these buildings happen to be very, very efficient because you can't guarantee the comfort and the health, i.e. control temperature and humidity, unless you do it efficiently. Because otherwise you just can't make it be comfortable because physics doesn't work like that. So a whole bunch of nations are getting to this point where they're mandating buildings that basically work like this, whether they use the passive house term or not, doesn't really matter. But they're getting there because our government haven't yet got there, unfortunately. They've lined up we've said that we'll get to net zero by whatever point in time, and buildings are currently generally a big chunk, 40% isn't unusual, of our energy as a nation, and therefore this 40 needs to get to zero. How on earth are we going to do that? And that's why they've started to do this, because they've also realized that 80% of the buildings that'll be here in 2050 already exist. So we've got to solve that problem. But if we're going to add another 20%, if we at least make that 20% like really, 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 really good, it'll mean that we can focus on the big problem over here. If we make these as bad as those, then our problem is bigger again. Yeah. See, it's just thing. It's not complicated at all, but it turns out that it's not happening, which is brain-fryingly stupid.
Yes, unfortunately. The actual, I guess, mechanics of it is easy, but the actual making it happen is the hard part.
Yes, it is, and no, it isn't, though. Like, we're really good. Humans are really good at making stuff happen. What are the examples? World War II, the Americans making fighter planes. Like, didn't make any, realized they needed some, and they made, I don't know what the numbers were, they made like 100,000 in 6 months or some phenomenal number from basically a zero start. Kennedy said in 10 years, we'll put a man on the moon. And they did. They had no idea how they'd do it at the start because somebody basically walked over there, put a flag on a hill and said, that's what we're going to do. And they resourced it, which is the key thing. And we're good at solving problems. The problem is no one's mobilized sufficient people to solve the problem.
Okay.
So we can.
Okay, so we can do it. We just have to actually do it.
Yeah. Funnily enough, it won't happen if we just sit around and talk about it.
Ah, dang. I was really hoping that would work.
To be fair, everyone wants to do as little as possible to get the best result. That's also human nature. So.
Okay. So if our listeners want to find out more about you and about Passive House and about your businesses, where should they go to find you?
So Envirotecture has its website, envirotecture.com.au, as does Passive House Design and Construct, which is passivehousedc.com.au.
Great.
I can be found through those. I'm also on LinkedIn a fair bit because I, as you might gather, enjoy a bit of a rant and a bit of a discussion with people. I think it's important. And if you want to learn more about Passive House specifically, there's a heap of stuff on our websites, unsurprisingly. But there's also the Australian Passive House Association, who are unsurprisingly there to sort of promote the benefits of Passive House. And they're a lovely bunch of people doing some really good stuff. So reach out to them too. And while it will be gone by the time this makes it into the world, I'm sure, twice a year, around the end of June and the end of November, there's also International Passive House Day, where people who own these buildings open them up to random strangers and say, hey, come have a look at our place. So that is, as we record this, that's this Saturday coming, the 25th, 4th, whatever the weekend is. And there's there's a lot of projects open. You can see all that through the Passive House Association, but that's twice a year. And it's really nice just to go and talk to the people who live in them. What's most interesting about those days and Sustainable House Day, which Renew run has a similar vibe, is that it's the people who live in the buildings. And while we as professionals will turn up and talk about the projects we designed and do our work thing, most people get the benefit of talking to the people who live in them because that's the story that you never get to hear because they just live in their house and they just do what they do. So it's a lovely experience.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to have to check that out. Not doing anything on the weekend?
You definitely should. There's a couple of really good projects in Melbourne. There's a few really good builders in Melbourne doing really good passive house stuff.
Oh, great. I'll have a look. And just for our listeners, we'll put those links into the show notes so everyone can find them. And hopefully everyone can check out a passive house next year or in November. Great. Thank you so much for joining me today. It was really great to learn some new things. I love that.
Excellent. I'm glad I've had a lovely time too, and hopefully some of my ranting also got a point across eventually.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Room by Room, produced by the Home Organisation Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes like this from across 10 life management perspectives can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and any other podcasting apps available on your smart devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating, sharing, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people to find it so we can grow and continue to bring you quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website, ho.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Gabriella Yastra, and thanks for tuning in.